Welcome to the Esports Business Network podcast. I am your host, Trent Knox. I'm the founder and CEO of Esports Business Network. This is episode number 15. Our guest is Nick D'Orazio, a graduate of Arizona State University, where he studied filmmaking. He has since established a career in entertainment, working on television, film, gaming, and much more. He finds himself now as a key opinion leader and journalist in the esports industry, working as the Director of Corporate Strategy for NVIN Global. When we come back, we'll learn about his history in gaming, what experience got him where he is today, and what he envisions for the esports industry of tomorrow.
This is the future. Evolution. This is the future.
But welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on to the show.
Hey, Trent. Thanks for having me. Yeah, man, it's fun. I love esports business. And I'm glad to see that there are more people not only talking about it, but spreading the good word, right? It's a lot of misinformation around here. A lot of people wanting to get into esports, not knowing how. And maybe we can talk about all sorts of things.
Yeah. I usually ask my guests first and foremost, like, what was their first introduction to gaming? And how did, where did you originally grow up?
So I grew up in NorCal, and so I guess if we want to say my first introduction to gaming is like just when I was a little tiniest kid. My parents were huge, huge gamers. They were very much on the forefront of gaming when it was just new. My father absolutely loved gaming, so did my mother. And I have tons of sisters, and we just loved gaming throughout my whole life. And I think because my sisters were so competitive and I were so competitive, just inherently, once, you know, four-player games became a thing, and once then it was just done, right? Like once the 64 was in our house, mm-hmm. and there were games like GoldenEye and Smash Bros. And Mario Kart, it was then a mad race between all of us to see who could learn how to be the best, who could learn the glitches, who could learn how to get the unfair advantages. And then naturally, you know, I started a PC gaming, which led me to StarCraft, which led me to Warcraft, which led me to the huge open world of the internet. And if there's one thing that really teaches you how bad you are, it's the internet. The mm-hmm. first time you play online against people that aren't your sisters, that aren't your friends, you realize, wow, the skill ceiling of some of these games I love is huge. So that was really me. I was a huge arcade guy. I love Street Fighter, love Street Fighter 2. Street Fighter Third Strike. I really loved the arcade scenes in NorCal. But then I guess my truest first esports, like I'm taking this seriously, mm-hmm. was probably Warcraft 3. That was when I started like entering tournaments, and I was ranked high on the ladder back then, and I really wanted to try to do something. But you know, like esports was so small back then, especially in the West, it was just a glorified hobby.
Yeah, you're slightly older than I am, and so the experience, I guess, was, you know, you were able to adapt into that Warcraft 3 scene a little bit earlier than me. What was like? What was culture like in Northern California for gaming in like in growing up in the school system, and like what were your friends playing? What was that like?
So fighting games were key, right?
Fighting games, okay.
Yeah, I moved away from a NorCal to Arizona when I was like 13 or 14, which turned out to be fantastic for a budding competitive Melee player, because so many of the Melee greats are from Arizona. It's just a thing. For some reason, the AZ zine is huge. You have Axe, you have Wobbles, you have Taj, you have just so many amazing household names, you know, back, especially in that like 2010, 2008. Scene. I'd say Axe is really the one to really make it his own. And now he's, you know, he's still competing at the highest level. We all love Axe. He really is the Arizona homeboy. But I started putting on tournaments. I started producing tournaments. And I guess to answer your question more directly, though, the NorCal scene and the Arizona scene was all about a trash talk. It's not something you see as often nowadays because esports has gotten more inclusive, and it is for the better. But I was essentially raised in an environment of gaming where if you can't bring the talk and if you can't bring the high level gameplay, you just get absolutely destroyed. No one wants to play with you. No one's going to invite you to the crew battles, right? No one's going to really take you seriously. So thankfully, I love to trash talk. I love doing a commentary way back in the day with Warcraft 3. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, you would used to do audio commentaries. Mm-hmm. So we used to record ourselves, and then a listener would have to download that recording, mm-hmm. download the replay, and then manually sync it up. So we'd be like 3, 2, 1, unpause. And then they'd unpause the replay, and then it would, that's how we did it. So yeah, things have changed greatly since then. You know, the internet has made it so it's not really that important if you're the best in your local scene. It's more like, are you the best on your coast, right? Mm-hmm. Are you the best in your larger region? Which is, as an esports journalist and as a content creator, very exciting.
Yeah. And I've had the privilege to actually see you speak in person when I saw you in DreamHack Anaheim. And then I've seen subsequently seen you speak in the virtual conferences and things like that. And you have such you're tenured, or you're very experienced. You have a long resume of experience going a long way back. And that's really something that's different, I feel, about what you're offering to the esports scene, is that you are more inclusive, I think, than a lot of people are. And and so what was it like while attending Arizona State University? What was the gaming and esports scene like there?
So one thing I love about ASU is, well, first of all, it's like one of the largest schools in the US, mm-hmm. right? In terms mm-hmm. of just attendance, in terms of people there. Mm-hmm. So my film school that I went to, you know, I was focusing on producing. All I wanted to do was learn how to make big things. Mm-hmm. So it kind of tied into esports because I was already putting on tournaments, but there was no esports degree. There was no degree, any of that. Mm-hmm. But since I loved film and I was a film editor just like on the side, that was a good place for me. But the size of the school made the gaming there fantastic, mm-hmm. because there were so many players. There were so many people. Our Melee weeklies and our Smash Brothers weeklies were like filled with people, like to the brim. I'm talking mm-hmm. like, you know, they would come to play and Axe would destroy everyone, but they would all come there essentially to watch Axe or to try to compete against him. And then when people realized that actual pros were coming to these weeklies, then some people would travel from outside the state, right? We'd have people come from California. So I'd say it was really good being in such a large environment because it really mirrored what I think is true and still about the esports industry. Mm-hmm. It's massive, and the amount of eyeballs and attention and the amount of popularity is so huge. So the only way to get noticed is to do something great. You really have to contribute. So me, you know, listen, I do love Melee, and I say I can play at a competitive level, but I'm no pro, like by any means, right? I'm not nearly as good as the top players. And I've learned that very early on in my career. What I can bring to esports is much more the behind the scenes guy. I can produce things. I can make it happen. Let's get the tournament started. So that I started to still be able to hang out with these pros and give back to the community through what I was good at. So I think ASU taught me that. You know, it's just such a big university. The only way to get noticed is to bring value. And I've done a lot of public speaking around other colleges. I try to speak about esports as often as I can. And sometimes when you're in a small school, you don't get that same kind of, I think, a harsh reality. Because if your esports club is only 30 people, well, then, okay, you're always going to have a place at the table. You're always going to make top 16. Mm-hmm. So you really don't have a drive to really hone your skills or really find your place. Because, you know, it's just, well, it's just us. Whereas with ASU, no, there were so many people who wanted to get in on the ground floor of it all. You really had to bring something.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I didn't get introduced into regulated tournaments up until 2013. I went to the University of Hawaii, And so while I was there, I learned about StarCraft. I learned about the Korean scene. And in learning that information, I learned about more of the collegiate side of esports. But prior to that, when I was attending Texas State University, which is like kind of in ways sister school to Arizona State.
For sure.
And yeah.
It's the same culture, really. Like it's just similar cultures. It's such a similar vibe there.
It is. This is a very, very similar. And I was attending there 2011 to 2012. So during that period in time, it was, still heavy sports based, heavy Call of Duty scene. And while MLG never made it down to us, there was still some tournament, organization going on. You wouldn't see as much. I would have loved to have seen a whole lot more Warcraft 3 in the scene, but it wasn't there as much as I think I would have liked to have seen it.
I still think that RTS is due for a comeback.
Yeah.
Right. I really, really do. I think that as people. So, OK, let's just give some context.
Yeah.
There was once a point in which game developers and those of us who were interested in the longevity of esports had a real concern in saying, are these games too hard? Mm-hmm. Like, is that actually what's good for esports? Because say, for example, there's games like Rocket League. And I'm not saying Rocket League is easy. It's not. But it's simpler. It's simple to grasp. It's simple to learn. Very hard to master. So that's like, man, that was something you heard so much in like 2015 and like 2010. Yeah. It should be easy to learn, hard to master. So it's interesting how now I actually think it's the opposite. I think people are starting to realize that, well, no, the games that actually succeed as esports, the one who have an enduring legacy, I mean games that last for more than 10 years, games where you can actually start talking about who's the GOAT, what's the greatest team of all time, which is, by the way, very, very vital if you're trying to get that esports consumer dollar, because if you don't have people who are so hardcore fans about teams or players, good luck trying to sell them a jersey for $80, or good luck trying to even emulate any of the revenue models that we often pull from sports, right? Mm-hmm. So you need these long, enduring esports. And if you look at the games that really go on, they are the games with incredibly high skill ceilings. They are the games that are incredibly complex. You still have games like, Street Fighter Third Strike. I love it. And it's one of my favorite Street Fighter games of all times. And if you look at the scene over there, in Japan, they're still playing. There's still tournaments there. They're still grinding away. Meanwhile, you have other Street Fighter games that are just as good, but they are more following that new school design mentality with comeback mechanics and easier inputs and simpler things. And there's just something about those games that don't have the enduring legacy. And I honestly think it's because in order to become a fan of these esports, you need to be impressed by what you see. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a sense of the play that I'm watching is impressive. Mm-hmm. So I think that, that and many other lessons are ways in which the esports industry, I think, even from a conceptual sense, is advancing. We're starting to understand why people like esports. Before we just thought, oh, it was just cool. It's like, it's just sports, but video games. Well, no, actually not quite. And I promise I won't try to turn this into a bash Overwatch League podcast, but the Overwatch League could have been so fantastic if Overwatch was just a more complex game with a little higher skill ceiling, with less forgiving mechanics. And if they weren't so concerned about trying to reach this broad appeal by having heroes that don't need to aim, heroes with huge shields that don't need to, you really don't need to worry about the accuracy of how you're placing them. And I think we will find more as we go forward. There's a chance for a return to form for these complex games. So long story short, I hope that RTS makes a comeback, because as more and more people become used to playing games at a high level, I think there's an entire generation that has never experienced the thrill of trying to control 100 units at the same time. And at the same time, how good it feels to know that I beat someone else who was trying to do that same challenge. That's a really, really a great feeling that still makes StarCraft an enduring esports that people watch.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
That was a lot of words. I talk a lot.
No,
I'm very passionate about esports.
I think fortunate for me, I'm someone who's, you know, learning and has been in the scene for now, what is 5 years. You know, I wouldn't say I'm, you know, the most well read, the most well experienced person, but I feel though that the experiences that I have added to some value that I can contribute to someone just starting, right? Someone that's just getting into it. Yeah. So the complexity of the business of esports is, you know, as they say, the wild, wild west, you know. When it comes to an RTS like StarCraft and the exposure of it kind of diminishing from when first it was GOM TV heavily producing content for it to the segue of live video going to Twitch. What do you think is like, what's the impact of alternative advertisement to esports? Like, I think one of the things, and I need to turn on a light, my camera's going out.
It's fine. I can see it.
One of the alternatives to what's going on right now is bringing more exposure to esports. Like you spoke about fashion, cultural musicians, and I know that you talk a lot about these kind of the culture of esports, and I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah. Well, so I love fashion. I love street fashion. It's just something that I really enjoy. I love art. I love music, and I have always thought that those passions of mine work very well in gaming and esports. I'm just one of those people who, I don't know, I've always thought, why not combine those things? Mm-hmm. And it's actually funny that you like mentioned, you know, like the Wild Wild West. Mm-hmm. And I just want to put a capital on West, mm-hmm. because it's not so wild and fragmented and like up in the air over in South Korea. Mm-hmm. It's not at all, right? The infrastructure there is like 20 years in the making. They have a huge head start.
Yeah.
And if you look at the way that their pro players, their esports community, their gamers view fashion, it's much like, it's already there. It's already integrated. Mm-hmm. You already have the general esports consumer accept and embrace an esports lifestyle. And that esports lifestyle does come with a certain aesthetic. It comes with a certain a mood. And I think a lot of where the West failed in that is that we stopped trying to advance the aesthetic of esports and what esports looks like. I often think of StarCraft II and how much hype there was for that game and then how it all just slowly evaporated. And if you really look at, say, for example, a convention like BlizzCon, which used to be the mecca of esports in the West, not even close now. Like BlizzCon has lost its esports luster, like, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago. And I think a big part of it is because it's like, it's so lame. All of the aesthetic is stuck in 2014. So much of Western esports is fog machines and green lights and big, dark, black, you know, big tournament settings and these people having these super serious poses with their big heads. It's like that. None of that is popular within like mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. Look at pretty much anything else that has mass appeal, and it's all incorporating new lines of fashion, new lines of aesthetic, mm-hmm. right? And at Invent Global, we are not only working on that because we think it's a good idea, but we're like working on it because it really is the most most practical way to plant a seed in esports that will eventually make tons of money. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that Travis Scott is in Fortnite. Mm-hmm. There is a reason that a David Beckham just signed with this big esports team, right? There is a reason that we're increasingly seeing people from the entertainment industry, from the music industry, from Hollywood, and just from general celebrity want to associate themselves with esports gaming and Twitch culture. And if all of that was too convoluted, just think of MTV, of early MTV, of early skateboarding, of early X Games. If you knew that this early weird niche thing would be the starting ground of one of the largest shoe companies ever, would be the starting ground of a fashion industry that is now one of like the top three, i.e. street fashion and skate fashion, you would have been all in on investing. Mm-hmm. You would have been all in on trying to cement your brand as one of the go-tos. And that's what brands like 100 Thieves, a Team Liquid, a Cloud9, mm-hmm. that's what they're doing now. And those investments is going to pay off in dividends in the next 5 years. Because as the esports consumer grows up, so does their expendable income. So does their care about how they look, how they're perceived as gamers. You know, I used to, and here's now a little personal confession. I used to get beat up and teased in high school for being such a hardcore gamer, right? Like gaming in the West used to be the opposite of cool. Mm-hmm. And now in high school, if you're a streamer, if you're a YouTuber, if you have any presence in the esports world or gaming world, you are the most popular kid on campus, full stop. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to say is people who are blind to the cultural wave that esports is creating, and if you don't see the business importance of that, and if you don't see the fact that, you know what, maybe esports org should stop trying to fight over the same core audience that we've been trying to I won't say pander to, but we've been trying to appeal to mm-hmm. for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. this 18 to 30 year old male. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to broaden the reach. And the one way to do that is to broaden the aesthetic, to make people say, that looks cool. Wow, that looks awesome. That pro player looks great. This looks really, really trendy. I want to become a gamer. I want to be associated with this. Because, you know, if you're trying to make it into the a mainstream, looks matter, and how you present something matters greatly.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it also goes back to something else you talked about, was communication. And I think that one of the things that, you know, I learned early on when I started attending conventions was the need for on-camera experience for players and for public relations training, and a lot of it goes back to kind of like what you're talking about, those organizations, 100 Thieves and whatnot, competing for the same demo and the same market, is that they've in ways created barriers to newer journalists, newer teams to get involved and open up the opportunity even for the older OGs to get exposure to new audiences.
You know, speaking of new audiences, what I think is most important about what these teams are doing, you know, the 100 Thieves of the world, mm-hmm. is that they're broadening their invitation to esports, mm-hmm. right? Like, say, for example, someone like me, I'm not into sports. I'm just not into real sports, you know, stick and ball mm-hmm. sports, not real sports, but stick and ball sports. Yeah. Right. And probably because I don't know, I've just never, I'm grown up around it. It's not something that I really relate with. And also too, you know, like I'm not comfortable in those settings. I'm not comfortable in a big, you know, a big in-person stadium or a big rowdy game in which everyone's cheering. And so it's just not something that I have much experience with, mm-hmm. right? However, I love basketball. I absolutely love basketball. I watch basketball of documentaries and clips and highlights constantly. Mm-hmm. I'm always watching things about who's the GOAT. I love to analyze the plays and so on. So I'm such a nerd about it, mm-hmm. because it's at its core such a fast-paced, strategic game. Mm-hmm. So basketball and sports is so big, they don't need to worry about extending the invitation, you know, to me. Mm-hmm. They are okay that they don't have my business. Mm-hmm. But esports, we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. We need to desperately expand the invitation to everyone, because esports and gaming, as we know, as gamers, is just inherently fun. It has such broad appeal. But there is a group of people who, I don't really consider myself a gamer. It's not something I've ever done. It's not something that I'm interested in. And then it stops there. So what I love that these brands are doing is they're saying, well, you know what? What if we get them into gaming through something different, mm-hmm. through apparel, through sneakers, mm-hmm. through lifestyle? And I think that is really where the immediate future is, because back on the topic of business, mm-hmm. the trickiest problem to solve in esports now is esports revenue. How do we actually make money through esports? And if you're not solving that problem, and if you're not trying to think about that problem, then you know you're very behind, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think going back to something else you said, that the capital W West portion of this, and that overseas, yeah. In Korea, Japan, and
Russia, China, definitely
Russia, China, they, yeah. they have a better solidified culture of professional esports. And, mm-hmm. I think in the US it's difficult. Obviously we're, land graph. We're there's the conventions are all over the place. Right. Yeah. And it's difficult to attend, all of them. And internet too. Right, the, infrastructure.
Yeah, the lack of internet infrastructure has always been a big problem for esports in the West.
Yeah,
it's tough.
But at the same point in time, with the, well, I mean, this is 2020. We just went through a pandemic. To some extent, still in a pandemic. Yeah. And markets like India are growing in mobile gaming. Markets like Brazil yeah. are growing in MOBA, you know, and the amount of, and recently France is contacting about things to get more exposure to their scenes locally. And it's,
and you know, what's fascinating, just yeah. one point, cause I'm so glad that you brought up Brazil
yeah.
and India. If you ever want to really have, you know, proof or evidence that one of these like emerging esports companies are the places you want to either be investing in or thinking about, look at what Google and the internet providers are doing. It is a mad dash to be who can be the company to provide 5G and fast internet to these countries. Mm-hmm. And it's like, now that is some real aggressive, you know, business war going on, mm-hmm. because these guys know if I'm the person to provide internet to India, like they already know that the esports and gaming explosion is going to be huge. So you can even trace back to how esports and gaming is affecting the world economy, right? Mm-hmm. As these companies become more interested in being a part of the esports and gaming scene, you have to think about the HyperX's, the Logitech's, mm-hmm. the Samsung's, all of the product people. Mm-hmm. They're now going to have a new consumer base to sell headphones to, mm-hmm. to sell Hertz monitors to sell keyboards to. Because esports, and the reason why esports has always been so big is because it challenges people to care about their gaming, right? And when you get people to care about something, they spend money on it. Yeah. So, you know, like esports has been this marketing layer for so long, mm-hmm. and I think it's finally going to blow up in an international way, I hope, in the next 5 years or so. But I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was just such a good point about how important these emerging countries are in terms of esports. It really is going to be where the future is.
Well, I mean, I guess this would probably be a little bit maybe of a stretch, but I feel like esports has opened up a whole new avenue for foreign relations. So, you know, yeah. I'm talking to, you know, people who are growing up in Venezuela that have, you know, it's very difficult for them to access PC parts and peripherals, and the cost for them mm-hmm. to ship the things to that area. And, you know, we had a guest on the show, Adam Bax, who's in Australia, who, you know, it's not very easy to get peripherals there, you know, in Australia. Yep. And Australia has an emerging scene as well, or has yep. an established scene. I mean, they've gone through some things that more recently, but they've been competitive. You know, Oceania yeah. In the area has been competitive. And so I guess What do you think is the key for people to get kind of on the same playing ground internationally? What needs to be done to maybe it's infrastructure, maybe it's IP, maybe it's what has to happen for everyone to kind of be on the same competitive page?
Well, for one, I'd say if I was in charge or if I was placed in a country with tons of potential or even just a city, right? Like we don't even have to get that big. But if I was placed in a place that said, Nick, you need to build an esports community. And then eventually this esports community needs to generate dollars either for the company you're representing or for the developers that want to market their game, right? So say that's the problem. What I would do is I would focus on the young generation of kids, you know, I'd say maybe 16 to like, you know, 24, and ask myself, what are they already spending their money on? Right. And I would look very, very, very closely. And then I would say, okay, this is what they like. This is what they buy. And then I would do a cross section to say, how many of them are gamers? Which one of them are the people who are interested in esports and are interested in gaming? Right. That is where I'd focus. I'd focus on what are ways in which I can convert the things that they're already spending on, but now they're spending these things to emphasize their gaming habit, their gaming lifestyle. Now, instead of buying a t-shirt that says a Billabong, they're buying a t-shirt that says some gaming brand, right? I think so like many times when people are tasked with making esports work, I think they forget that at the end of the day, esports is how people identify themselves. People say, I'm a gamer. What does that really mean? It means that they're identifying, this is who I am. And when you have that, this is who I am, there's so much potential to draw consumer dollars from that. And I say that with the most positive thing. I want people to buy in to esports. People need to start paying for esports. For so long, esports has been free. You just watch a stream and that's it. You know how much money goes into these world championships and yet people can just tune in for free? And why? Because we're trying to get the largest audience possible. Because how are we trying to make money? Through advertising. It's just such, it's not sustainable. It's not scalable. What I want to happen is people to start paying for esports and being happy about it because the esports offering has increased in quality so much. So we pay for things all the time. We buy coffees, we buy new video games. Why is it the esports market hasn't figured out ways in which we could offer something that also gets people to pay for stuff? So that's where I'd start. I'd start with the product. I would view esports less as a, I'm just really interested in getting people to watch. And I'd say, no, I'm really, really interested in getting people to make that purchase decision and make it be a positive one and say, wow, I'm so glad I bought this season pass, or I'm so glad I bought this jersey. I'm so glad I bought this mouse because it actually makes me better as a gamer, or it's something that now my friends think are cool. You know, it's things like that. And, you know, traditionally that's been esports, at least in the West, it's been our hard point because, you know, like esports wasn't made by business savvy people, you know, like esports was made by people, you know, when I first put on tournaments, we didn't really care about any of the money. The prize pools were at best $50. People literally paid just because they wanted to be the best. They wanted to be, you know, pride. And that's fine if it's not an industry. But the fact that esports dares to say that there's careers in the space. We dare to say that you can get a like job in esports. Okay, that's pretty bold of you to say. You need to have a plan on how your business can, you know, scale up in the next 10 years. So I take that very seriously about like esports revenue. I'll say it again until I'm blue in the face. So many people are trying to worry, will esports be popular? Yes, it already is. You don't need to worry about that. Esports will, it's already on that launch pad growth. What you need to figure out is, how do I make money off that growth? How do I ride this wave and then bring a quality product or offering or experience? It doesn't have to be like a product. It just has to be something in which consumers feel good about purchasing. Because I feel good about purchasing movies. I feel good about my Netflix subscription, right? These are things that I like and they bring me joy. So how come esports seems to have such a hard time with that?
Yeah, I think going back to BlizzCon, I think they were one of the first ones to try to tackle it with the virtual tickets and you know, personally, this would have been my first BlizzCon if there had been one. I would have gone.
I love BlizzCon. I know I gave some criticism. Yeah. I did a quick jab at BlizzCon and saying it's esports luster, but I say that with love in my heart. I've worked at BlizzCon before. Yeah. I've been a talent manager like at BlizzCon. It's one of my favorite events. I actually went to the very, very first BlizzCon in 2005. And I've seen the way this event has changed. And I think the problem is Blizzard stopped caring about if their games are competitive. Mm-hmm. And they only started focusing on, you know, the whole play nice, play fair, play fun thing. I love that. There are, you know, mm-hmm. these are these company standards. But eventually, if that's your esports driving factor, you need to have, you will lose the core, like, esports audience. Mm-hmm. You will lose the people that want to be pro. I'm at your game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Heroes of the Storm, I covered that game for, like, literally since it was in its early beta, since the death of its esports scene. Mm-hmm. I was writing about it. I was interviewing the devs. I was interviewing the pro players. I know exactly why that game failed, because it doesn't reward being good at it. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't reward being good at it. It doesn't matter if I'm the best player in the world. If I have a teammate that's garbage, I will lose. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can't carry in Heroes, and by the way, you can't carry in Overwatch, these are things in which I just think that, I don't know, they lost the heart and soul of esports. And then, you know, like, BlizzCon as a result becomes less about esports and more about buying the plushies in the merch store. And then, you know, that's a whole nother podcast to talk about what's going on with Blizzard. By the way, grats to all of those devs who are now, like, moving on to their own businesses, right? Or their own design teams or so on. You know, good for you. Get out while you can. Anyone with talent at Blizzard, get out.
Yeah, they've got some wild things going on behind the scenes over at Blizzard. I think the one thing I think that people who are newer to the industry, even myself, when I look at a market share of $1 billion, one person could own the whole of esports. And that makes it very very difficult for people to think of there being opportunity in doing it. Yep. I think one of the first things that people ask me is, how do you get started? And often I have to say, go volunteer for something or offer a service to somebody who's, you know, already successful to a degree, and see if you can make add value to their content. When a market is only $1 billion, now when you open that up and you look at gaming as a in general, obviously there's much more opportunity there, but esports, gaming is the reason why 100 Thieves aligns more with a cultural brand than they are an esports organization or FaZe Clan or any of those teams that are Southern California based.
You know, one thing that I always tell to people when I'm asked the same question, right? How do I get into esports? Mm-hmm. I often say, get a job outside of esports. Mm-hmm. Don't work in esports right now. Mm-hmm. Go get a job somewhere else and learn how to do something that esports desperately needs. Mm-hmm. Right? I was a producer for the entertainment industry for years before I suppose you can say my esports career became something that paid enough that I could do it full time. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be fair. I was always writing esports. I think side hustles are great. Mm-hmm. Even throughout film school, and even throughout my whole career in film, I was writing esports blogs. I was writing for sites. So, like, I just like to write. So that was my side hustle. Mm-hmm. So I kind of kept my foot in the door. I kept relevant in that way. But here's just an example. I name names, but former intern at Blizzard in their esports division. She's doing great work. And then the internship ended and she had all sorts of opportunities. Oh, like, what are you going to do? Where are you going to work for? She did the smart thing. She now works for Walmart, and she's doing their like product licensing or some big job within Walmart that has to deal with like international product stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I'll tell you right now, when she's done the time she is now, she'll be able to find any job within esports ever with that type of experience. Because that type of like real world experience, you don't need to be this esports expert. You really don't. You don't need to like be this, I've been in esports for so long and I know every single patch note to so-and-so. No, what you need to do is you need to understand the esports industry. You need to help us make money. That's it. Mm-hmm. If you can help us make, if you can help us solve those core problems, you can find a job within esports. Mm-hmm. So I'm always telling people, just learn a skill. Learn a valuable business skill. Learn how to pitch. Learn how to sell things. Learn how to understand audience spending habits. Mm-hmm. Learn how to market. It doesn't matter where you learn how to do these. In many ways, if you learn how to do these things outside of esports, you're going to get a better education because you're going to be working in industries that aren't 10 years old, right? Or aren't this quick. Mm-hmm. You're going to be getting a much more a robust network because these are people who have been in their line of business for 30, 20 years, going to give you all this advice. And then you'll be able to bring that in to esports. So yeah, sometimes there's this mad dash to get associated with a team because, oh, look, I've did it. I've made it. Not really. I don't think you can consider it making it when you're getting paid less than $40,000 a year to work a very expendable job in esports, that you are the absolute lowest person on the totem pole. And when these volatile esports companies eventually either lack the funding to keep you around or someone looks at the budget sheet and says, oh, this person we hired isn't bringing in money worth more than their salary, you're just going to lose the job. And I see that so often in esports. It breaks my heart. The truth is, this industry is so young that I often can't in good conscience tell people, oh yeah, chase your job in esports. No. Chase your passion in esports, learn about esports, always keep esports in your mind. If it's your passion, yes, but that doesn't mean you can't be learning a business skills otherwise. That doesn't mean it's noble to be starving as you're chasing this esports dream. No way. Find a job somewhere else. I think that's very vital advice. It's not fun advice. It's not sexy advice, but it is advice that I think long-term will help you live your esports dreams. Because all the people I know that bring true value to organizations in esports have years of experience in some outside industry.
I like your perspective. And I like that. I don't like the fact that, and you probably wouldn't like that, an experience in esports, if you're just starting out and one of those unfortunate events happens, that you really have nothing on your resume. Like, where are you going to take that experience to? I guess the next thing is for those people who are creatives and want to build something for themselves, what kind of advice do you have for them?
So for one, you got to stop caring what people think and you got to stop caring about views. Number one, because I would rather have my podcast, my video be high quality and it be seen by 10 people that matter, as in 10 people who can maybe green light it, 10 people who can see the value of it and say, you know what, this is actually really good, than 10,000 people who are just, oh, that was fun, fans. Oh, great. That's great, right? I think it's so important to focus on quality. So important to focus on the sustainability of your creative project, right? It feels good when, because, you know, I was a video editor for years. I've edited for YouTube channels. I've done all that. I know it feels good when you make something and it gets 100,000 views. It feels even better when you make something, it gets 1,000,000 views. I get it. But like, in order to make a living off that, you're going to need to make another video and then another video that gets 1,000,000 views. You're eventually going to want to own a house. You're eventually going to want to do, right? So you have to look past the ego, a satisfying thing of I've done it, I've gotten the likes, I've gotten popular. No. View this project as portfolio building. Mm-hmm. You are building a portfolio and you will eventually show it to someone with a budget who can pay you to make work that isn't yours. And I say this as someone who went to film school, mm-hmm. who went to art school, right?
Yeah.
It's so, so important that your creative passion is yours, but your job is something else. Mm-hmm. And again, this isn't sexy advice, but I really do think it's advice that a lot of creative types need to hear. It's not a net loss if you're doing something creative for a company mm-hmm. that isn't yours. Mm-hmm. That's great. You have so much time on the weekends or so much time on your off days to work on your stuff. Constantly be building that portfolio, right? What I hate the most and what really, really discourages me is when I see people start a really awesome YouTube channel or start a really awesome podcast and they don't have an end goal. Mm. Like maybe your end goal would be, I want to do this for one season or 1 year. Mm. I want it to be as high quality as possible. And then I want to sell this or use this to get a job. Mm-hmm. I want to use this thing I'm doing to convince someone I can make your organization better.
Yes.
Right. But so many times people don't think that far. They just think, I want to be a creator. I want to be like a creative person. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I get it. 0.5% of people are able to make it happen. Mm-hmm. They have the charisma, the energy, the sustained a creative vision that allows them to stream. By the way, I can't do it. I've tried to stream. I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't stream for more than 2 hours. I get exhausted. I can't stream every day. I can't be this person that creates content every day.
Yeah.
But thankfully, I'm this person who, in trying to do that, learned a set of skills that companies and organizations really, really value.
Yeah.
So I love creative people, but sometimes it's like this, I live the creative dream or bust.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not a good way to forge your career at all. You should be a little more flexible in how you make a living doing what you love.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess the third character or archetype in this esports world is the investor with money that's burning a hole in their pocket. And
oh yeah.
And they have no direction. They're seeing the popularity. What's sort of like yeah. your advice for someone who's so green and a green investor with money burning a yeah. hole in their pocket that wants to get into the business? What's some of the advice you have for them?
Well, for one, don't start an esports team. We've already learned that lesson, right?
Yeah.
Like just don't do it. I don't think that is a business model that works off of investor dollars because, you know, esports orgs need to have a sustained revenue and sustained fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And that only comes like organically. That only comes when the right group of players get together in the right game and they create magic and they create authentic fandom. You can't force people to care about your team.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. And you can't do that with dollars. You can't do that with investment. I mean, we've seen that with the Overwatch League. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine spending $20 million to own Florida Mayhem? Like, can you imagine you spending that much money to own a team that literally no one cares about? You're not making money on jerseys. You're not making money on anything. No one's eager to do Florida Mayhem, you know, collabs. I don't even know who plays for Florida Mayhem. And yet someone paid $20 million to be there, right?
Mm.
So that's number one. Don't do like an esports org. Personally, I would view this time for investors, this is when you go with the disruptive esports content, the people who are trying to do something completely new,
mm-hmm.
the people who don't need a ton of money, the people who aren't asking for millions. I'm talking about the people who say, hey, here's this weird plucky idea. We're a bunch of young esports fans and we want to do something differently. Those are the type of people that I think need investor dollars more than ever because they have the hunger, they have the drive. And those are the things that I think have the actual a potential to go huge,
mm-hmm.
to go viral, right? If I was an investor and I had to, and now here is my most measured answer. So number one, don't invest in these words org. Number two, start looking at the little guys who don't need that much, but you know they're going to work hard. You know they're going to try to be doing something great. And there's a real chance that they'll create authentic fans. And then from those fans come community presence. Then from community presence comes money, right? The third thing is any sort of tech
yes.
that makes advertising throughout tournaments or individual streams
yes.
or anything that like removes the friction, I think is a very great investment. One of the a company I saw that was probably the coolest thing I have ever seen was it's a company that allows you to, so their tech, say you're a Twitch streamer, mm-hmm. you put their module or their software on your stream
yeah.
and it reads the current map you're playing on. So say I'm playing like CSGO, yeah. right? It knows all of the walls on the game because it has a huge pool and it knows. So it is then able to, if you look at a wall, your advertisement for whatever you want comes up.
Yeah.
And it's so smart because it's not, it's putting that advertisement through your stream. It's not putting that advertisement through the game. So you're not even breaking any of these developers' user agreements. You're not changing the game at all. So all you're doing is you're making your stream super, super intuitive. You're making ads on your stream immune to ad block. Mm-hmm. You're making ads on your stream native to the game and so, so authentic. Now, every time your stream has a viral moment, every time your stream has an awesome play, that video, that YouTube thing, that advertisement is going to live on the side of this wall or whatever, you know, forever. Yeah. And that's just one, you know, company, because I hear a lot of pitches from companies, mm-hmm. but it's things like that. It's things like that, that I think are where you should be looking at. You should be trying to find tech that makes it easier for people in esports to make money, because right now mm-hmm. we don't know how to make money for the most part. Like, it's just a big question mark. How do we get people to pay? Because here's some little stats for you. The average sports fan, every time that you successfully get a sports fan to engage with you and bring out money from their wallet, mm-hmm. the average spend is about $55. $55. I think it's like $50 to $60, mm-hmm. right? Guess how much the average esports fan pays when you finally get them to agree to pay for something. Guess how much?
$3.
Yes, exactly. It's $3, yeah. right? That's the problem. And in that is the opportunity, because there is nothing culturally different about a sports fan and an esports fan. Mm-hmm. The esports fan is just used to paying $3.
Yeah.
It's not that the esports fan has less money. It's not that the esports fan wants less quality. It's just that the esports industry has only figured out how to sell them things worth $3. So that's what you need to be focusing on. Anything that focuses on, I'm going to increase ad revenue, or I'm going to increase the buy, that's what I would invest in.
Mm-hmm. So as far as like offline, I think online, of course, those sorts of things are very intuitive. What sort of offline things are you looking at as far as like companies like Esports Arena or LAN Center or Nerd Street, which is not LAN Center, Localhost. Yeah. And what do you like about that? And what do you not like about it?
Well, for one, I think it's a very, very unlucky break about all the people who invested in the arenas and all that. Like that's very unlucky, right? But at the same time, I don't think COVID actually changed the long-term trajectory of how these things would succeed. Mm-hmm. I say this because I have sat through so many in-person tournaments in my life. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun. Like, I'm sorry, it's not. It's not fun to sit for sometimes 6 to 8 hours, because that's how long mm-hmm. these tournaments take, in a cold theater or in this small seat thing with all of your friends all sit up in a row, and you're just watching what is essentially a stream. Mm-hmm. The viewer experience of esports is infinitely better at home. Mm-hmm. Like, it just is. Yes, you lose the crowd and you lose all of that, but unless your game is able to gather that type of hype, and, you know, as someone who loves to going to these conventions, mm-hmm. that's only possible when you like gather together, you know, 5,000 of the most hardcore people. Mm-hmm. So this concept of like general weekly esports viewership, like, oh yeah, buy your ticket to go to the Overwatch League. There's a reason that the Overwatch League matches are no longer happening in the Burbank Arena. Mm-hmm. There's like a reason that they tried to do that for like, you know, a year, and then they realized this is horrible because mm-hmm. it's not fun. Mm-hmm. So on the flip side, one of the most prescient things I've heard about in-person esports is a writer. You can find her on Twitter. Her name is Pash, often known as Pash Notes or Amelia Watkins. She says that young esports audiences come to a game and they want to find a community, but all they're turned into is audiences. people misunderstand the appeal of esports. No one wants to be an esports audience. You want to be an esports community. That is gaming. The only reason any of this makes sense is because I'm watching with my friends and then I go home and play with my friends. So I personally think that the concept of more community-based esports centers is huge, especially in college campuses. If you had to invest in anything in person, I would say if it's on a college campus, if it includes a snack area in which you can sell people snacks and Pepsis and Red Bulls, and if it includes high-powered PCs that people can access for cheap, would be absolutely ideal as if they could access it for free because the cost has been lumped in their tuition. So all they do is swipe a card. And in the same way that colleges have been making money hand over fist through gymnasiums, you can make that same money with these cool esports community things, with these cool esports community centers. That is where I think if I had to even place any bets, that's the only way in which I think a real life in-person esports thing works. Because, you know, I don't like you are competing with my a bedroom with my personal PC setup that has been made to my exact wants and needs and all of my snacks from the fridge. And like you are competing with that. And are you really going to win? I don't think so. But the one thing that you can compete in is community, is in-person tournaments, is I'm meeting new people. I'm meeting new friends. I'm meeting new people that have an interest in esports. Shoot, I'm taking a date to this place with me because we both love gaming. That is where any sort of potential lies in, not this passive, you know, 500 people show up and watch an esports stream from 100 feet away on like a big screen. I just don't think it's viable.
Absolutely. I definitely agree as far as in-person things that the, it really is the championships that, you know, when everybody is there, that the audience, right. That it becomes the value, right.
Like, you know, the international, big Dota tournament, everyone always includes the international and all their pitch decks and good. No, the only reason it's that big is because it's one central event. So like if we really want to expand our conversation here, maybe there is some potential for more Super Bowl style events. Yeah. I personally love Evo. I think it's one of the most hype esports tournaments ever because it is, it has that appeal. Yeah. It has the appeal that I'll travel from a different country just to go to Evo.
Yeah.
But this weekly thing, I don't think esports is hype enough to encourage people to go in the same way that people go to a baseball stadium and, you know, season tickets. That's just not how it works. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
I agree. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. I wanted to ask you one last thing. For someone who's just getting into the industry, what would you say they should do first? What should they do first?
You should look inward. Look inward. Look deep, deep within yourself and ask yourself two questions. What do I like to do? What am I good at? What am I good at? Because whatever the answer to those things are, that should be something that you can do every day at 100% without a losing steam or hope or enthusiasm. You're not going to succeed in gaming or esports if you're not able to bring enthusiasm and passion every day. This is what I've learned working in the entertainment industry. When you work for a quote unquote cool and fun sectors, you just have to assume that everyone there knows that it's a cool industry. So the amount of passion and enthusiasm they bring is massive. So if you have that esports fire, great. You're already step one. Next step is what can you personally bring to esports? And you also need to be a little easy on yourself. Don't compare yourself to what you see people bring to esports and then think, I have to emulate this. No, forget that. What can you personally bring? Are you a stats guy? Maybe you really love organizing things, or maybe you're very passionate about art or color blocking. Like, who knows? Find what you love and then say, is esports missing this? It's probably yes. Esports needs far more diversity. in the things people bring, far more on diversity in the offerings we have, right? We're already seeing this with the explosion of a popularity of KDA, right? This whole Riot Strange experiment with what if we infused fashion and music, and what if we infuse this with esports? Mm-hmm. Yeah, turns out everyone loves mm-hmm. it. Why? Because it's the first time we've ever seen mm-hmm. it, right? Why did it take that long for someone to realize that maybe there are other ways to enjoy esports? So that's what I would do. Look inward. What can you personally bring? And then just you know, like, go easy on yourself. You're going to fail. You're going to spend 20 hours making something, and then you're going to upload it, and it's going to get no views, and no one's going to care. That can't be your measure of success. Your measure of success is, am I getting better? Is the quality high enough? Because eventually the right person will watch your video and they will listen to it. And that person is the one that will then email you and say, hey, I have this opportunity, or hey, I'm trying to build this content team. And then bam, you've made it. So you have to keep rolling those dice. And every time you swing at the ball, you should be trying to hit a home run. I'll end the esports talk with a sports metaphor, right?
So Nick D'Orazio, where can people find you or connect with you?
Oh God. Honestly, if you've gotten this far, I don't think you ever want to hear a single word from me ever again, right? Like, how many topics did I rant about and ramble about? You can find me just at invenglobal.com, right? You don't want to find me. You want to find all of the cool content creators that make all the esports stuff for our company. I guess you can find me on Twitter at, I think it's Nick D'Orazio 3RD, third, that is. You can also, this is an open challenge to anyone who wants to play me in Melee on Slippy. I'll beat you. I promise I will. This is an open challenge. So if you want to play me on Melee, you can just DM me on Twitter or something like that. This has been super fun, Trent. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about some more things. You know, didn't even talk about Valorant at all. And
I didn't. I mean, were we supposed to talk about Valorant? I didn't know.
Not at all. I just think that we got a lot of other things that the emerging esports that we didn't really talk about. And I'd like to have you on the show again to talk about those things.
Yeah. Well, Trent, I'd love to. It's a cool. And by the way, congrats on episode 14.
Yeah.
That's an achievement in itself.
Yeah.
The fact that that sustainability is very hard to do. So yeah, man, keep it up. I want to see episode 140.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Make it happen.
Much appreciated. Thank you guys for listening. This has been the Esports Business Network podcast. Take it easy.
Cool.
Hey y'all, it's Trent Knox, founder and CEO of Esports Business Network. I want to say thank you for listening to this podcast. If you're finding value in the podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you share the podcast to your network and write a positive review on your preferred podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, feel free to make a contribution to our working capital accounts on Cash App or PayPal. Our username is ESPORTSBIZNET. That's Esports BizNet on both platforms. As always, we'd love for you to join our community and platform at https://www.ebn.gg. You can take advantage of a free subscription to our bronze membership by following the directions on the homepage. Part of the bronze membership is access to our Discord server and private membership channels. The conversation only evolves with participation from esports entrepreneurs like yourself. We need to hear about your esports business to understand how we can move the industry forward as a community. You can also join the community by joining the Facebook and LinkedIn groups. An additional goal of EBN is to move the conversation forward on your preferred social media platform. So as a last note, don't forget to follow us on social media for current events, news, and other esports related topics. Follow and subscribe to Esports Business Network on social media. Looking forward to networking with you very soon.